This episode of The Tome Show is brought to you by Noble Knight Games, where Out of Print is available again. And listeners like you, thanks for using the Tome's Amazon store.
Hi, this is Keith Baker, creator of Eberron and Gloom, and you're listening to The Tome.
Welcome to The Tome, episode 156. The Tome is a D&D news, reviews, and interview show, and I'm your Tome host, Jeff Greiner. In this episode, I will be joined by a modern-day legend to forge, well, a new legendary world, as Keith Baker joins me and will throw down some advice on world-building. So, obviously, the first bit of news in this episode is that my guest tonight is Keith Baker. Welcome to the show, sir.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Technically, I think this is welcome back to the show. A contributor of mine did an interview with you at Gen Con several years back, but this is the first time I've actually talked to you.
But it's the first time I'm here in person. It's a whole different experience. I love what you've done with the place.
Well, thanks. Yeah, I put out some flowers and ran a dust cloth over a few things just before you got here.
Chased out the rust monsters. I know how it is.
Exactly. You know. Other quick bits of D&D news to discuss before we get into the real meat of everything. It was recently announced that there will be a new version of the Character Builder coming out that, instead of being a downloaded app, is going to be a web app run entirely online. I'm looking into possibly doing an episode focused on that if I can get some of my contacts to be willing to come on and chat about it. So hopefully that'll be coming out later this month. So look forward to that. Have you had a chance to look into the new Character Builder at all yet?
I have not. Honestly, I don't even use the online one. Not the online, the downloadable one. I just do everything on my own sheets. But yeah, I mean, certainly it's obviously big news right now.
Yeah.
So the main thing is I'm Mac focused, so all this PC downloadable stuff doesn't help me much.
Right. No, and I am as well. In fact, I purchased a copy of Windows to install on my Mac solely to run the DDI tools. I mean, literally the only thing I run is the Monster Builder and the Character Builder.
Yeah, it's for me. I have another PC I just don't use very much, and I'm like, damn, I guess I better download the character, the last version of the Character Builder before it's no longer available.
Yeah, but what it might do is it might create problems for those people who were buying a 1 month subscription one time a year.
Uh-huh.
You know,
well, obviously that's sort of the issue here. Is as it stands, you buy your 1 month subscription, as it were, you get the Character Builder, and you basically get access to everything they've done. So certainly from an economic standpoint, it's really a terrible model for them. That doesn't help the gamer on a budget, of course, who, likes the fact that they can get what they need.
Sure.
On a small budget. So, it's all see both sides of the fence.
Right. So anyway, like I said, we might have a whole episode on that, and I've got lots of different thoughts to share on the subject, so I'll save it for that. It's also worth noting that pretty much all of the Essentials line is out now, or at least it's out now if you have a Wizards Premier store nearby that gets things early. I've got an episode planned to look at the second half of that, because we did a previous episode that people seem to like that combination of voices, so I've got the same guests I'm trying to wrangle in to come back for the second look at the last half of Essentials. Have you had a chance to look at the new Essentials line?
Yeah, I have. I actually am near a premier store, so I did pick up Heroes of the Forgotten Kingdoms last week. And among other things, I'm curious to see where they go with working that into the new character builder, you know, how they merge the things. But yeah, I've checked it out. I've made a whole bunch of Essentials characters just to try out all the different classes. And still sort of seeing how everything plays.
Yeah, and I don't know if you saw, they released a video today, sort of a demo video of how the new character builder works, and they build an Essentials character first, and then they go through and build sort of a customized non-Essentials character afterwards. So they're both in there.
Cool.
I don't know how they mix and match. Like, can I take Essentials powers with my normal fighter sort of thing? I don't know.
Well, I mean, that's always been the big issue, is I've run games now with both Essentials and original characters and had no problems with, you know, haven't particularly felt there's been any huge balance clashes or anything like that. But you have that broader question of, yeah, things like multi-classing or stuff like that. I mean, obviously the Knight and the standard fighter just mechanically are completely different. And the degree to which can an Essentials character take a multi-class feat from the original, and what does that mean when they do? But overall, I'm actually enjoying a lot of the new classes. There's a number of things they've done. I actually quite like the new approach to things like marking, and the new approach to the Warlock's Curse that the Hexblade uses. I've actually changed my other Warlock, you know, my old school Warlock that I used in a game recently, I changed to use that model because I just found it, you know, easier for the player. So we'll see.
Yeah, right on. So yeah, and we'll look into all those a little bit more. I'll have the whole team on and we'll investigate and discuss and see how all that comes down together. I know there were some balance questions in the first of the players' books, and we'll see if that holds true with the second one as well.
Yep.
And if anybody wants to participate in that conversation, feel free to call the Tomes Biz line at 919-BIZ-TOME with your questions, comments, or thoughts on any of those things that I've got upcoming episodes on. But now, let's go ahead and find out who the heck this Keith Baker guy is, in case somebody doesn't know. Keith Baker, who the heck are you?
I'm the luckiest gamer in the world. So I am best known for being tied to the Eberron campaign setting out of the fantasy setting search that Wizards of the Coast did in, I believe, 2002. Aside from that, I was doing some freelance role-playing work before that. I also, before that, was working in computer game design. Since then, I've done a lot of different RPG work. I've written 6 novels set in Eberron. And I've also created the card game Gloom, which picked up an Origins Award. So that was awesome. And have a bunch of things coming out in the future. But basically, computer games, role-playing games, novels, a little bit of a lot of different things.
So you're living the dream.
Well, yeah, as I say, some people, as I said, I was doing freelance role-playing work before Eberron. And there were certainly some people when Eberron was chosen who were sort of frustrated. And they're like, but he's already been published. This isn't fair. You know, someone actually specifically, the quote I liked was, it's like Kid Rock winning the Star Search. And I was like, I don't know whether to be insulted or flattered. But the main point is, yeah, I'd done some work for Atlas Games and I'd done a little, you know, some work for Goodman Games. But yeah, the idea of having something of mine come out as a sort of flagship setting for Wizards of the Coast was not something I, you know, saw as happening. And it's certainly, I've been messing around with D&D since I was 9 and always dreamed of getting to work in gaming, but I never expected to have this level of success with it.
Sure. And I'll have you know that we recently ran a poll over at one of my other websites, Temporary Hit Points, asking players what's the most fun setting to play in, and the clear winner was Eberron.
Excellent. I'm glad to hear it.
Yeah. So let's go back a little bit. And how did you first get into D&D? Let's you know, obviously you've got some geek cred, but where does that start?
Mm-hmm. So that started when I was about 9 to 10 years old. I got the white box of Dungeons and Dragons and the hardcovers for Advanced Dungeons and Dragons. And at the time, I was basically too young to actually really run them, but I just really enjoyed reading them. You know, you've got the monster manual. It's got all these, you know, fantastic monsters with these stats for them. So you can actually, like, make them fight each other. And deities and demigods, you know, the original, even I think it was the paper version I had before it came out with the hardcover. I always loved mythology and folklore since I was, you know, a kid. I had a great little Horus costume that with cardboard wings that I made when I was in kindergarten. And so, again, here's like stats so I can have Thor fight, you know, Thoth and see how that works out. And so it was just a lot of fun for me to read. And then probably around fourth grade, I would say, I started getting my friends to try this out. And, you know, just sort of built from there. I certainly tried everything I could get my hands on. You know, I remember Stormbringer and Call of Cthulhu, you know, the old Palladium system, even the original Mechanoids before we had a Rifts and such. So, yeah, just sort of tried a little of everything. And that's where, as I said, I always knew from a very early age that what I wanted to do was create role-playing games. I just, you know, when I got out of college, I was sort of like, okay, now how do you get that job? What do you do? So it took a while to make it happen.
Very cool. And then you really sort of came into the public eye with Eberron. And as you mentioned, you've just sort of wrapped up the sixth Eberron novel. Can you tell us a little bit about what that novel is?
That novel is called The Fading Dream. It's the third novel in the Thorn of Braylon series. It's not strictly speaking a trilogy, but now, you know, don't know when the next one may come out. And the Thorn series is basically each book is intended to more or less stand alone. It's basically sort of James Bond meets La Femme Nikita set in Eberron. You know, it's Thorn is a Dark Lantern, which is a spy in the service of the Nation of Braylond. And so, you know, within the books, she's infiltrating different, you know, infiltrating a House Tarkanon, which is a pseudo-terrorist organization. She's dealing with, you know, political turmoil in Droam, or in this case, sort of investigating this mystery with the Eladrin and whether they're connected to the Morning, this terrible disaster that ended the last war in Corvair. So part of the idea with Thorn in the series was my first series, The Fading Dream, not The Fading Dream, The Dreaming Dark, all about dreams. Anyhow, The Dreaming Dark is more of a sort of classic fantasy group of adventurers travels around the world pursuing, you know, in conflict with the great evil. And while the places and people are unique to Eberron, the story is very much a sort of traditional classic fantasy thing. And I sort of wanted a story that was in some way more unique to Eberron. And one of the key ideas of Eberron is how would magic be incorporated into society? And that's where I wanted to say, this is a setting where we're in the middle of a Cold War. What is espionage like in this world? You know, what is James Bond like in a world where, hey, you can have an intelligent dagger or a Medusa dictator or, you know, what have you. So that's what makes those books interesting, in my opinion. And you certainly can pick up Son of Kyber or The Fading Dream without having read the others, but you'll get the most out of it if you start with The Queen of Stone and work your way through. There's certainly character development as you go.
Very good. Along with that, into other projects, I understand you've recently done some work on a board game.
I have. So, as I say, I've done Gloom, which is a non-collectible card game that's been out for a few years now, in which you basically have a family of eccentric individuals and you want them to suffer miserably and die while keeping your opponents happy, healthy, and alive. And I'm doing some more things with that. I just finished work and got a deal on a board game called The Doom That Came to Atlantic City, which I am making with a good friend of mine, Lee Moyer, who is an artist who's done a lot of art for Eberron. Among other things, he designed the Dragon Marks and did a lot of the recent maps. Anyhow, so it's basically sort of the reverse of Monopoly and Arkham Horror, where instead of building a city and closing gates, you're a great old one destroying a city and opening gates. And it's definitely goofy fun, and hopefully will be out sometime next year.
Very cool. And as I understand it, just before we got on to start talking about this, you've just returned from a charity event that you've been running.
Yes, I was out in Los Angeles doing a event that was raising money for children's literacy. And it was being hosted by Meltdown Comics and was, you know, various writers and musicians and people sort of coming and playing D&D. But, you know, a lot of sort of interesting people just from across various entertainment industries. And it was a fun experience. I put together an Eberron game for that. And I was happy with how that worked out. And hopefully it was sort of just a test bed for doing more of that in the future. We'll actually, the sessions were recorded. That's going to be posted in various places in the future. And we'll be putting the adventure up at some point, which will be, you know, any profits from that will go to the charity. So there'll be more info on that, I'm sure, on my website as soon as it starts coming together.
Very cool. So. And then last thing before we get into the meat of everything, real quick, I think we'd be remiss if we did not mention Have Dice Will Travel, this fun little project you've got going on. Tell us a little bit about that.
All right. So last year I just decided that I sort of was wondering, because I knew people played Eberron around the world, and I put up a thing on my website saying, hey, I'm going to travel around the world, and if you're willing to put me up for a few days, I'll run a D&D game for you. And the basic concept was I'll come to your area for 3 days. One day I'll entertain you. I'll run a game. I'll, you know, we'll do some Gloom. We'll talk about whatever you want to do. One day I want you to entertain me. You know, what is it I should see in your place that I wouldn't see on my own? You know, what is it that as a game designer and a writer, I really ought to see while I'm here? And one day I'm on my own business. And I had no idea what the response would be. I ended up getting about 270 invitations from across 6 continents. Overall, I would say my goal is I want to try and run in every state in the U.S. and as many other countries as possible. And I'm just very interested in trying to see as diverse a range of gamers as possible to sort of be able to show people just how diverse people are, both in terms geographically and socially. So, yes, you know, I've played with the convenience store clerk who lives with his parents, and I've played with, you know, Coca-Cola marketing executive in Bulgaria. I've played with, you know, hey, strippers and porn stars in LA. that just trying to sort of see how far that all goes. I've actually been running the same adventure, which I've now run 52 times. Wow. And it's always been very interesting to see. It's still something where, in part because of the design, you know, the adventure is very open in its design. And so even after having run it 52 times, I'm still seeing new things happen, you know, every time. And it's very interesting to see sort of what paths different groups take. In any case, I'm hopefully going to be getting some online articles about that going soon. And that'll be something that will be definitely pointed to on my website when that happens. And it's something I hope to write about more in the future. I certainly have more invitations so far than I've been able to take up on, follow through on, but I am hoping to get back on the road next year. And, you know, again, people who are interested can certainly get in touch with me and, you know, feel free to extend an invitation.
All right, so let's take a quick break to mention our sponsor for the episode, Noble Knight Games. It's a brick-and-mortar store that also has a great online store that specializes in finding the things that you're looking for that are out of print. But it's an easy way to get new products as well. And my pick for this episode is the novel, The Queen of Stone. Maybe I can convince our guests here to tell us a little bit about it, although you mentioned it earlier.
Well, as I say, that's the first in the Thorne of Braylon series. And again, Thorne is a spy in Eberron. In The Queen of Stone, her mission takes her to the nation of Droam, which is a nation of monsters. So it's run by a trio of hags, and it's a nation of minotaurs, trolls, gnolls, medusas, and others. And they're basically holding a summit with ambassadors from the five nations to sort of be recognized as a nation. Thorne's going there for that, but also has a secret agenda of her own dealing with the Queen of Stone, the Medusa Queen Sheshka. And it's basically both her first story, you know, a look into this wacky espionage scenario, but also a chance to look at Droam itself, which is one of my favorite places in Eberron, as that idea of what does a nation of monsters actually look like. So, like that.
Very cool. And you can find that at Noble Knight Games for under $6 right now, and make sure to tell them that the Vorpal Network sent you.
Noble Knight Games has been serving the needs of thousands of gamers worldwide since 1997. With a huge selection of over 30,000 unique products, including discounts on most in-print games of up to 50% off or more. Noble Knight Games is the place for out-of-print RPGs, board games, war games, collectible card games, miniatures, and all things game-related. They ship worldwide and will purchase or trade your titles you no longer need, new, or used. Your satisfaction is guaranteed. Just visit www.noblenight.com or visit our website for direct access to thousands of new, out-of-print, and in some cases, one-of-a-kind items.
Now, it's time to get into it, the meat of our conversation tonight. Let's create a world. And the basic idea here in our brief email conversations was you like to create worlds by figuring out some of the quirks of what's going on in a setting and just sort of drawing that out to its logical conclusions.
Yeah, basically, in my opinion, you know, you've sort of got two ways to go. You can start really small, you know, take a really isolated place, you know, here's one village and build the world out from that. Or you can start really large and sort of say, well, what is, you know, are some of the defining aspects of this world. You know, this is a world where it's always night. This is a world about to fall into a terrible ice age, you know, so on and so forth. And, you know, you can sort of go any which way. But to me, it's always interesting to sort of pick something and say, and how does this make this not the world we know? In Eberron, one of the whole ideas was to say, if arcane magic exists in the way it was presented in third edition, how would that evolve and be incorporated into society over time. If we'd had arcane magic in the Renaissance, what would our world look like today? Mm-hmm. And that's the kind of thing I'd like to do, is to say, if we have this tool, if we have this monster, if we have whatever, how does that change the world?
Right. So the thing that we decided to focus on for our world that we're going to talk about tonight is the idea of being able to bring people back from the dead. Because it's one of those things that it defies logic to some degree. If you could, you know, for a handful of gold dust or diamond dust, you could start raising people from the dead. There has to be pretty broad implications of that.
The thing about it is it's something that's always been part of D&D and that is primarily there when you functionally get down to it, because player characters die and we need to bring them back so that our story keeps going. The problem is the spell as written in most editions is in no way limited to player characters. And it's something where very few settings that have come out, really ever unincluded. I've tried to limit it in various ways in certain supplements, but it really doesn't feel to me like a world in which the implications of this spell have been considered. And to me, it's an interesting thing to think about. How would the world be different if you could reliably raise people from the dead for 5,000 gold pieces worth of diamonds?
Right.
So, yeah. So how do you want to dive in here?
Well, let's start by thinking about what would some of those implications be. You know, we talked about if it takes a handful of diamond dust to bring somebody back from the dead, then what, then anybody can be brought back from the dead. Death is a very non-permanent thing. What does that say about our world? You know, first of all, it tells us, I think, what kind of resources are going to be valuable.
Yes, suddenly diamond mines are going to be immensely important strategic locations. You know, whoever's controlling the diamond mines, you know, suddenly has power over life and death. And again, assuming that we're saying literally it's diamonds, which is what it is in the previous editions, as opposed to just generically residuum in fourth edition, which gets even worse, because then you can't even say, oh, you know, again, the country with the diamonds has power over it. But again, so if I'm creating a world around this, I definitely focus on that. I definitely say it takes diamonds. Here's the diamond rich nations. And this is a source of political power for them. You know, this is sort of one of the things that makes the world interesting. Second, going back to your point, is, well, it's not a trivial thing. You know, even if we go by the 5,000 in diamonds, that means you're not bringing back peasants.
Right.
You know, it's not just anybody in the street can do this, but it's really hard to get rid of anyone who's got that kind of money. And presumably you're going to get some sort of insurance thing going on where, again, you know, the evil dictator is going to make sure he's got an account going on. So if anything happens to him, he gets brought back. And that means that those people are, by and large, only going down because of old age. And that also makes the races like elves or dwarves that live a really long time suddenly having another, you know, interesting angle there, since old age is the only thing you can't bring people back from with those spells.
And as a campaign setting, as a gaming world, this, I think, sort of opens up some new creative angles, because assassination suddenly becomes a lot less powerful, but kidnapping is huge.
Absolutely. And see, and this is also where – depends where you want to go with it, because fictionally, you know, looking to fiction, one example where this question has been brought up is Stephen Bruce's Vlad Taltash series. And there he's got a character who's an assassin in a world where people can be raised from the dead. And his answer to that is to create a tool which stops people from being raised to the dead. You have Morganti weapons, which essentially soulbind people. And so that's one option on that, is to say, yes, it's possible to raise people from the dead, and here's what stops them. I think it's more interesting to do just what you're saying, is to say, you know, the point of this world is people can be raised from the dead if you have the money and such. And then you get exactly what you're talking about, that if we capture this guy and kill him, he could be resurrected, even if they don't have, you know, the body. True resurrection will do the trick. But as long as we keep him alive, then, you know, we've got him. So prisons become a big thing. You know, prisons for people who have the resources to be resurrected, prisons are more important than execution. And that's interesting. To me, one of the things that immediately comes to mind is that this is going to be a world where wealth is extremely important. You know, getting the money so that you can be resurrected if you die is going to be very important to people. So you're going to be very pragmatically driven in that sense, and that you'd have a very sort of generally different outlook on life and death than we do, because death is something you can avoid if you can afford it. But beyond that, if one sticks with the idea that the raised dead line of spells are divine, it also means that suddenly it's your priests who have the power over life and death. So theocratic power is going to be a major thing. And, you know, you're largely going to have likely some very powerful theocracies balanced off potentially by, you know, sort of trade lord kingdoms in the diamond rich areas, mm-hmm. who can sort of afford not to follow the faith because, well, you need their diamonds, you know. So that's a thing I would see as an immediate possibility for driving character stories, is you can easily go for the sort of oppressive priesthood that sort of controls life and death, and you've got to do things their way or you die forever. Now that then leaves a lot of room, and this is sort of moving into our next thing, to say, if you essentially have your oppressive faith that is using that as a tool, you know, as a force for control, saying, well, you know, you've got a small force of clerics, paladins, whatever, from a more benevolent faith, that believes, you know, this shouldn't be a tool. This is a gift. You know, life should be celebrated. It shouldn't be something that's just a commodity. That immediately gives you a sort of, you know, oppressive force with rebellious heroes to play around with if you want to go that way. Otherwise, as you said, you just came up with the whole, well, let's switch it and we'll do the Inception thing and, you know, we'll be the team of expert kidnappers. Mm-hmm. And, you know, no one said we had to be the heroes in this world. So there's a lot of different paths you could take.
And so I kind of see, it seems that logically to me then, since the priests are going to be the people in power, by and large, mm-hmm. in this world, but you also have deities of very opposing sort of philosophies, that you would probably have multiple nations with very different outlooks and philosophies, because they're being run by followers of different gods. You have, you know, sort of a split that way.
And that's very much the question. You know, I mean, that's where it comes to now, what do we want this world to look like? Because one of the questions is, again, what you do with religion. So, you know, in Eberron, for example, one of the conscious decisions with the setting was that the gods were not going to walk around the earth. You know, that we do not conclusively know if the gods exist. We have faith. We believe that they exist. One of the reasons we believe they exist is because divine magic works. But it is possible for someone to say, I think divine magic is just sort of another form, another way of manipulating the same energies a wizard uses. So what I always liked about that, sort of the reason we went that way, is because it means faith matters. And, you know, when the gods, when you can go and chat with a god, when he can come down and get into a war on your world, it's not a question of faith, because his existence is beyond question. But if it's a matter of there's mystery to it, that yes, the priests can work miracles, but do we know that that goes to their gods? It's a very different thing. So hold that thought, but then say that comes to the question of, do we know the gods exist? Do all faiths have access to the same powers? You know, is it that resurrection is in the hands of a particular faith or force? Or do you want, you know, as you said, every nation to have its own differing faith, and some of which are more benevolent than others? Do we essentially go to Canada for, you know, cheaper healthcare because, hey, their God will resurrect you at half the price, as opposed to folks here in, you know, Transylvania sort of making you slave for 20 years to have a chance at resurrection in the lottery.
Right. And see, I sort of see, I mean, regardless of whether they're actually our gods or whether they're walking the earth, the priests are still probably of different philosophies.
Certainly.
So you could still have them develop, you know, leadership over various nations, and then that creates other interesting issues, because obviously you've already got an issue of rich versus poor going on here, mm-hmm. where wealth is really important, and then you've got this idea that your religious philosophy becomes really important. But if you're the good guys, mm-hmm. what's your response to this whole thing? Because is it right to take money to raise people from the dead?
Right. And I think there's a few different things that immediately come to mind with that. You know, again, just looking at different ways cultures could evolve. On the one hand, you could have the sort of oppressive tyranny, which is simply the people in power get resurrected and the rest don't. And your only hope at resurrection is essentially to rise to a position of power. Mm-hmm. You know, so that's option one. Option two, you could say that, no, we believe everyone has a right to be resurrected. The problem, of course, is we don't have the resources to do it because it does take all those diamonds. And that we might have something like, for example, a lottery system. You know, put in so many hours of community service and you get drawn the lottery. And that could lend itself much more towards, again, a sort of, you know, socialist people working together. And the luckiest of us, those most in need, you know, whatever, are the ones who receive this gift. And those would be two very different societies. You could even have, again, a sort of raiding culture that is all about, we're just, you know, take the Mongols and say what we're essentially doing is running around beating people up and taking their stuff precisely so that we have enough diamonds for our priests to raise people. You know, to raise our people. And I think in terms of good or bad, it comes back to that, what sort of experience do you want to have in this world? You could play the cynical, you know, again, going more the sort of noir way, you could play the cynical people who just live in this world and they're trying to get enough money yourself to ensure a ticket not to the afterlife, and, you know, again, play the kidnappers, play the smugglers, what have you. Or you could do something like, if you said we live in the oppressive civilization where this thing is being used as a tool, that, again, you're of a faith that was wiped out. You know, you're from a faith that was oppressed because it opposed that approach. And that you're trying to spread that faith and rebuild it. You know, you're trying to perhaps find a better way to raise people from the dead that isn't as expensive, you know, that takes puts power, that power back in the hands of the people. And that would be something, obviously, the folks in charge, let's say you could get a way to raise people from the dead for a gold piece. Well, you know, that would undermine the whole power structure of that priesthood. So not to mention potentially their tenets of faith. So that could be, you know, again, a campaign arc of trying to find that better way. Or alternately, another weird way would be to say you're trying to end resurrection. You know, that what you've decided is this is what's keeping these bad people in power. And that, frankly, no, people shouldn't be brought back from the dead. This is, you know, if you look to Eberron, there's a group called the Children of Winter that are actually all about the fact that death is part of the natural order. And, you know, people are messing things up with everything from, you know, healthcare to resurrection, and that this is causing a big spiritual imbalance in the world. So it'd be interesting to have that you're fighting for the right to die, as it were.
Absolutely. And I think what's great about sort of the concept as we're discussing it and building it and all that kind of stuff is it's a world. So all of those things that you've mentioned, all of them right. can be in the world. You know, it's not just it's not just the world's about this or that. All of those things could be there. The one thought that I did have, or that I might suggest mm-hmm. to add to that, is you talked about one mm-hmm. sort of raiding culture trying to steal the wealth in order to be able to raise their people, which seems like a negative proposition. You know, the idea because when you, immediately in my mind, when somebody says raiding, I'm thinking, you know, Vikings and that kind of stuff. And, you know, you're probably going right. to lose more people than you get diamonds to raise in a proposition like that.
That's a good point. Depends how badass you are.
Right.
It also depends, of course, are you trying to raise all your people, or are you just trying to raise the important ones? So when I was thinking Mongols, my main point was not, oh, and they're going to raise every one of their warriors. They want to make sure they can keep the Khan alive.
Right.
You know, they're doing it so that their greatest heroes are never going to die. Yeah, they'll lose 100 soldiers in the process, but, you know, they're proud to die for their, you know, their eternal emperor, if you see what I'm saying.
Right. And that even got me thinking that, you know, even if that's not the case, then you can start to say, well, what if you have this culture that springs up that's much more secretive? You know, they're more about mm-hmm. – they're raiders, but they're not sort of Viking or Mongol raiders. They're more of, we're going to sneak in and steal stuff in the dead of night and just disappear. And so you sort of kind of – instead of creating this sort of raiding culture or nation, you could almost have right. this global conspiracy thieves guild, you know, who's all about stealing the diamonds yeah. for themselves.
Absolutely, and that gets totally to a sort of Ocean's 11 story where, again, you know, the oppressive nation of, you know, Barangia has – they're enormous diamond vaults, and you're going to steal those diamonds. Boom, adventure. But going back to sort of what you were saying before about how all of these things fit in, that is sort of the point of raising a world, and this comes back to the very beginning of the conversation, where it's large and small. So what I'm saying is that we've now created the broad, you know, the large thing. We've said this is the hook to this world. This is something that is going to affect everything. And we've started looking at lots of possibilities. And probably what my next step would be is to pick one of those and say, this is going to be the country I'm going to start in mm-hmm. and really try and hammer down that country. And certainly thinking of things like, you know, the neighboring forces that are going to play a role in this game, like is that Thieves Guild around? What about the Merchant Guild that, you know, again, are the big diamond traders? But again, sort of saying what is the campaign arc of, you know, this initial sort of story I want to do and build out from there and say, oh, yes, well, you've heard stories of, you know, the country of such and such where, you know, anybody – has a chance in this great lottery. But yeah, you've never actually been there. Mm-hmm. And surely that's just a myth. But again, it's that point of you could be Ocean's 11. You could be, you know, the heroes rebelling against life or death. If you're doing this as something you want to sell, you need to develop all of those. If you're just doing this at home, well, which one of those stories is the one you want to focus on?
And make the rest of it up as you go.
Yeah, or certainly just as you have time.
Yeah.
And part of it is exactly that you know, this is the stuff that to me, this is just fun, is just sort of suddenly realizing, no, wait a second. Yeah, what about the Thieves Guild that, you know, we didn't think of that right away, but that makes perfect sense that there'd be, you know, this international, you know, diamond thieves, you know, the Black Diamond or something like that.
I could even I could see a way to fit the shard mind race into the world very integrally.
Absolutely.
You know, a race that otherwise is hard to sort of fit into most worlds suddenly makes a lot of sense in this world because maybe they're out there to protect the diamonds, you know, being diamondish sort of people themselves.
The funny thing, I think, would be to say that the shard mind could actually very much fill the role of sort of the Deva in some of the other settings, of the idea that you're a returned spirit who, instead of returning in the body, has returned, literally animating. Yeah, you know, probably wouldn't say they're made of diamonds, but it's that same idea of what is it about the diamond that makes it an integral, you know, a vital component. And that would actually be cool, is to say that they're tied to this actual mystery of why diamonds? You know, what is it about the diamond that makes it this vital component? Well, the shard minds have a connection to that. You know, I think that's very interesting.
I think that's cool. All right. Well, I don't know that we've built a world, but we've certainly built sort of some concepts that could be fleshed out into a world. Do you have anything else you want to add on that?
No. And that's sort of the point to me, is that, you know, in 15 minutes, you're not going to build an entire entire world, but it's getting that hook to hang it on and then expanding out from, you know, that first footprint. I'm interested in putting it together. So take it from there.
Very good. And if anybody does take some of the ideas from this world these discussion anyway and put it into their world, I'm sure both of us would love to hear it. Go ahead and leave a comment in the show notes or send an email or a Twitter or whatever. I'd be happy to share anything I get with you.
All right. I look forward to it.
All right. And now we're going to hear a combo mini segment from SlyFlourish.com and SarahDarkMagic.com, squeezing in a few extra bits of advice for everybody.
Hi, this is Mike Shea from SlyFlourish.com, and I'm here with Tracy from SarahDarkMagic.com, and we thought we'd talk a little bit about world building. So Tracy, how do you build worlds for your campaigns?
Well, so far I've only built one, but basically I start with the map and I try to lay out a few cities that I think will be interesting. And then I'll start with the city that I think the players are going to start in and just try to figure out who might live there, what they're likely to build or import in that city, and just go from there. How do you do it?
Do you spend time on NPCs, or do you tend to focus more on the environment? You know, are you structural? Are you more, do you spend more time with attitudes? Where do you find yourself spending most of your time when you're building out your initial cities and things like that?
I spend a lot of time trying to figure out what the factions are likely to be. So when I built Barmouth, which was the first city I ever built, I said, okay, well, this is definitely going to be a port city and they're going to have shipbuilding. And part of that is there's going to be an influx of people coming in from other places, so a lot of foreigners and a lot of people who made money from the shipbuilding who maybe didn't start with money. So there's this tension between the upper and lower classes, foreign-born versus native-born, and just went from there and built a town council that, you know, I think three-quarters of them were hereditary and a quarter were elected, and it just went on from there. And then I try to figure out where in town they're likely to go and build a few NPCs.
Yeah, do you kind of start with the hooks for the PCs, or do you kind of start with the story and let the story kind of generate for a while before you figure out exactly where your PCs are going to fit in it?
Usually I let the story generate just a little bit more, but those are like also hooks for the PCs, like the tensions that were. So from that city, I built the other cities. Like the city inland was all old blood, and they didn't really like this this city down south. And that helped my players decide where their characters might be from in that area. And the tension with the shipbuilders and the elves in the forest also helped provide some reasons for why some of the characters might be involved.
Right. Cool. What are some of the hardest things about world building that you see?
Well, part of it's just you know, if you just build your world by yourself, getting players to buy into it can be hard. That's one of the biggest stumbling points for me and some of my friends that I've heard right. who've also built their own worlds. And then just the level of detail right. that you want to try to get into, because some players are going to want to know what day of the week it is and month and what the festivities are and what color the banner is when they get into town. And other people right. are just like, where are the orcs? When do we start right. killing things? And you got to make sure right, you have right. both in there, or else your players will be upset.
Yeah, sure. That can be tough when you have different players on either side. I have kind of a different way that I handle world building, which is I don't really do world building. I like to really start small and just kind of focus on exactly what my next adventure is going to be about, you know, what my next evening is going to be about. If I've got six people coming over next Wednesday night, then what exactly am I going to plan out for them? And I usually try to build some interesting NPCs, and a lot of the generation of the rest of the world comes from those NPCs. So, you know, it might just be a you know, guy that runs an inn that's hiring the PCs to do something, but it turns out that he's actually got a different agenda, and that kind of expands outwards and builds out until that starts to make the world larger. But I tend to find that when I spend a lot of time building out like a whole world, then the PCs only see one tiny sliver of that world, and I've spent all this time on stuff that they don't actually see. So instead I try to just worry about what the PCs are going to see, and then that ends up driving the world where it is. So, you know, example, in a higher level campaign, they went to Sigil, so I spent a fair bit of time thinking about the area of Sigil that they were spending their time in. But I think there's like 12 neighborhoods in Sigil, and I only really spent time in one of them. So that's the only one I ever really worried about. And that right. way I could kind of make the things that they see richer without necessarily having to spend a lot of time on things that they weren't going to see. So it's a different approach, and it's worked well. One other thing that worked really well for me, Dave Chalker from Critical Hits has a technique called the 5x5 method that he uses. Have you heard about right. it?
Yeah.
Yeah, so that works. I found that to work really well for kind of a mixture of sandboxing and you know, adventure planning, where I don't want people to run on the rails, but I also don't want to just give them a totally open world and I have no idea where they're going to go. And the 5x5 method allows you to build five different paths that they could go down and build out five steps from each of those five paths. So you have and then interlink some of the related steps across the paths in order to create kind of this mesh of a story. And it works really nicely because it's a nice structure and it's easy to build in. And as far as players are concerned, they feel like they're in an open world, even though they have these different avenues that they're going in. And you can always expand on them. So I use that one a lot too. It really helps me kind of make sure that I'm giving enough options to players. So those are both pretty interesting ways to do world building, I think. And hopefully people found those useful. So it was good talking to you, Tracy.
Good talking to you too.
All right, so we're back, and it's now time to talk about the other side of the screen. Usually world building is the domain of the DM, although there's certainly some collaborative approaches that could get players involved. But let's talk about players specifically here. You've got a player, you're trying to fit them, you're trying to make the new character, you're trying to get that character into the setting, whether it be Eberron, a you know, Forgotten Realm, some other published adventure, some homebrew setting, whatever. How do I make my player character actually meld with the setting?
Mm-hmm. So, you know, things to me are, one of the things is looking to the major themes of the setting and trying to give those both a tie to my character, but also sort of saying, how do these make, you know, how did these affect making me the character that I am. When I look to Eberron in particular, you know, so I'm saying I'm starting off as a first or second level character. Eberron is based on the concept that any player character is pretty cool. That most NPCs use NPC classes, and, you know, next to a commoner, even a second level fighter's pretty awesome. And in Eberron, that defining thing is the last war, where you've had this enormous civil war that has been going on for 100 years, and has only recently come to an end. And so to me, one of the things I always ask the players is, what did you do during the war? Either did you fight? If so, who did you fight for? And if you didn't, why didn't you? You know, you're a capable fighting guy. You're a wizard who can shoot fireballs. What were you doing instead of fighting in the war? So that to me, and often what I'll do is actually run an adventure set in the war as a sort of look to something like Firefly, where, you know, you start off with Zoe and Mal actually as comrades in the war. And that's sort of a good way to bring a group together as opposed to the, oh, we met in the tavern, is to say, well, there was a time when we were soldiers together and now the war's over. We're trying to figure out what to do with all our various skills. Other groups I've had have sort of played off that. So, for example, we had one group that they ended up deciding that they'd all come from the same tavern, that the halfling rogue had originally been the innkeeper. The warforged fighter was the bouncer that she'd bought for the bar. The cleric was sort of the drunken Friar Tuck type figure trying to sort of now clean up and make a difference with their lives, so on and so forth. And the idea was that the inn had burnt down and, you know, now they're out in the world doing their own thing. But sort of taking that basic, what is, you know, what is important in this world and how may it have shaped me into the person that I am? Why am I a fighter? Why am I a wizard? If I'm a cleric, clerics have the obvious hook of I have the gods, but am I, you know, was I called? Do I just believe in this? You know, how did I become a cleric? The last thing I'll say on that before I shut up for a moment is a great example I had of this in one of my games was someone playing a cleric of the Silver Flame as a changeling. And the Silver Flame is very easy to play as the I'm the lawful good, out to crush evil sort of thing. What he went with instead was saying that he was a changeling, he'd come into the church, and he encountered corrupt priests in the church and was very thrown off and disturbed by this, and that he'd basically gone out into the world to try to understand corruption, you know, to try and basically mingle with the low lives and figure out what made them tick and what this was about. And that was a very interesting way both to keep him from being the annoying, you know, awful good character, as it were, while also adding this greater depth that he's this very good person who wants good for the world, but still is just sort of trying to understand why is there evil. You know, is sort of more to it than just the surface thing.
And I think that brings up the point that it's oftentimes easy to get caught in this mentality of I like my character to be the exception to the rule. I personally have had a history of doing just that thing, of saying, oh, this is going to be the norm for the campaign. I'm going to go completely, you know, sideways and do something different.
Mm-hmm.
But this story that you tell.
So in other words, you're the one evil drow in the world.
Right.
Because apparently they're all good.
Right.
Anyhow.
So, but yeah, but your story there actually shows that you can be unique and what have you, but still connect yourself to the world. So even if you're going to do something completely different, do maybe one thing that's out of left field. And otherwise, try to make yourself fit into the world. You know, if you're going to be the one monstrous race, then make that make sense within the setting of the world. And don't necessarily do the I was off in the wilderness and nobody really knew anything about me, and then I ran into the party and that's where we start. You know, because that doesn't connect you. That doesn't connect you to anything.
And another thing I'll throw out there is this isn't sort of specific to any setting, but it, you know, ties to any setting, is family is something a lot of people never think about. You know, do you have family? Do you have siblings? Are your parents alive? What do they think of what you do? What do they do? Where are they? Because that's something as a DM that can be an interesting little hook to, you know, hey, suddenly your sister shows up and she's joined the cult of such and such. And what do you do about that? You know, just again, giving a little more depth to who you are. One of the things the game Over the Edge does that I like is has every character define an important person, someone who has been an inspiration or who you particularly care about, and a secret that is something that your character doesn't ever want anyone to know and that potentially they might never know, but that it's, you know, good for you to think about. What is the one thing, you know, why is this secret important? Is almost more important than what it is just that sense of I'm more than just a fighter. You know, I may be just the classic, I hit things with a sword, but why did I become a fighter? What's my inspiration for that? What am I, you know, trying to accomplish? Is it just get rich? Is it impress my father? Or, you know, that's what he always did? You know, so on and so forth. Just a little more, even the simplest, most standard off-the-shelf character can still have a reason for why he does what he does.
Good. So one last sort of thing to consider. We've talked about ways to connect a character to the setting and, you know, get information about what's going on in the setting and use family connections and all these other things. But I think it's worth mentioning why. You know, if I'm having fun making my half-orc fighter and or barbarian or whatever and going out and killing everything in sight, what's the advantage? What do I get out of actually connecting the character? Why go to all that extra effort?
Now, it really depends, of course, what you get out of gaming. You know, if you're playing it as more of a war game, then largely this sort of thing isn't necessary. What I like about role-playing is the sense of creating an interactive story, that what we're doing is writing a novel together or creating a movie in which you're the characters. And it's a lot actually like Inception, with the idea of the architect creating the, you know, the maze, but the dreamer populates it. You know, I can create this story, but without you, the characters, you know, it's all about you. And so for me, the more you define your character, the more I can then make the story about you. You know, you tell me who your family is, then I can work them into the game. You know, you tell me who's your greatest inspiration. Maybe you'll meet him. Maybe he'll be threatened. You know, it's just I can make the story about you in a way that I can't if it's just, well, you're a completely generic guy, so I guess we're going to kill some monsters to get some gold, because why not? You know, the more you tell me about who you are, you know, it's pretty much, again, just like watching a TV show. What's more interesting, a story where the character has some depth to it or a story where the character, we never find anything about him and all he does is shoot criminals? You know, but yeah, like that.
Yeah, good. So, I think having that connection to the campaign setting makes the role-playing part a lot easier, if nothing else, you know? Some people struggle with that bit, but it makes the character feel a little bit more real because it makes sense within the cohesive nature of the world.
And it also helps define the story you want to have. Uh-huh. So, again, looking to another character in the game, a game I ran recently, the same one that had that silver flame guy. He was a paladin of the Blood of Vol, and he decided that the king of this country had basically, his father had been unjustly killed, and that he'd been smuggled away from the country and was going to be sort of, was raised by this, priestess figure to get vengeance for his father. And that he was going to go out into the world to build his skills, find allies, and try and ultimately get his revenge. And the thing about it is that people who know Eberron, including this player, know that, oh, actually this priestess figure is this horrible evil person who's, you know, basically an evil mastermind. And his whole idea for the character was, yeah, he'd probably overthrow this king eventually. So, you know, again, that's sort of his heroic tier experience is building power and allies. Paragon experience is to try and overthrow this king. And then epic experience is discovering, wow, I was an idiot. I'm being used by this evil person. I've done a terrible thing. How can I fix this mess I've just made? And my point is that he knew that going in. He knew that, you know, he's saying, oh, I'm going to find out that I've actually been working for Sauron this whole time.
Uh-huh.
But he liked that idea of, I've got a story that I'm going to try and work through. He didn't know how it would work out. What allies would he run into? How would he try and overthrow the king? But he knew that this was sort of his idea for where his story would go. And knowing that, that meant I could work around that. I could build stories that, you know, would end up that way. It's sort of like saying you're going to the bookstore, you're reading the back of the novel. You don't really know what it's gonna how it's gonna work out, but you know that this is the two sentence description of the series. You know?
Good. And I think I would even add to that that if you're going to go around like that, it's probably a good idea to talk to your DM ahead of time. Because if the DM has a story or a campaign arc in mind that doesn't go that direction at all, that's a conversation worth having before both of you start making plans.
Yeah. And among other things, I'd say that that example I just drew up was a very specific example. Mm-hmm. You know, he had a pretty clear idea that in a lot of games wouldn't have worked at all. I basically was saying in that one, hey, tell me your ideas. But yeah, if I've been planning to run a war story, if I've been planning to run a thing where this is about overthrowing the, you know, tyrannical resurrection agents, then, you know, that idea isn't going to fit into it.
Right.
But to me, it's all about that. Talk to your DM, because the whole point of doing this background, as we've said, is to give the DM ideas for what's the story you guys want to play. But ultimately, the DM has to buy into that. And I'll, you know, say off the top of my head, I dropped a group at one point because I just didn't like the story they wanted to experience.
Sure.
You know, that basically I was just like, it's not that they were doing anything wrong. They just wanted the story one way, and I really didn't. It wasn't something that I enjoyed. And so I was just like, you know, I was the wrong DM for that group.
Right on.
So, yeah, you know, got to find something that works for both of you.
Very good. All right. So, in summary, what we talked about today is we discussed some advice for DMs to make worlds where you can start with just one concept and then draw that to its logical conclusions. We did that with the idea of raising dead costing, you know, diamond dust to start bringing people back from the dead, and what does that mean about gods and how nations form and important resources and all those things. And we also talked about how if you are willing to put the effort into making your character tie into the setting, you're going to get more role-playing potential. You're going to get to help guide the story a little bit so that you're experiencing the story that you want to experience. And all in all, it can be a very rewarding experience for everybody at the table. Does that sort of summarize real quickly what we talked about tonight?
Sounds right to me.
All right, then I'm going to call this episode 156. I want to thank our sponsor for the episode, Noble Knight Games, as well as Tracy Hurley from SarahDarkMagic.com and Mike Shea from SlyFlourish.com. And of course, I want to thank our guest of the episode, Keith Baker. Where can people find you around the internet?
People can find me at BossyTheCow.com /HDWT for Have Dice Will Travel. And I'm also as HellCowKeith at Twitter, and just as Keith Baker on Facebook. So yeah, like that.
Good. And people can, of course, email me at thetomeshow@gmail.com, visit the forums over at gamershavenpodcast.com, and call the Tomes Biz line at 919-BIZ-TOME with your thoughts, questions, or comments for upcoming episodes, or maybe you want to say something about this episode. Send it along and be part of the show. Don't forget to consider checking out the Tomes Amazon store for products discussed on the show and more. The show gets part of the proceeds, and that helps keep us on the air. Links for things mentioned in the show can be found in the show notes on the website at thetomeshow.com. And this has been episode 156, wherein we have crafted a world in just about an hour. Seems more efficient than most of the creators in the various myths, but it helps when you have the aid of a professional like Keith Baker to give advice on world building in this episode of The Tome, The Tome, The Tome, The Tome, The Tome, The Tome.
I'm on the wall.